abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Thursday, January 23rd, 2014. Talking to Bob Murphy today. He's taking your questions on economics, the economy, etc. We're going to start off with a discussion of the minimum wage and what all these economists who suddenly favor a minimum wage increase could be thinking. Before we get to Bob, though, I want to remind you guys of the importance of subscribing to this program on iTunes or any podcatcher you like, because in the coming weeks, I am putting together an ebook of transcripts of all the exciting interviews we did on this program in 2013. And I'm going to give that ebook away to you listeners for free. But how are you going to get that ebook if you don't know where to look? And to find out, you're going to have to listen to the program. So don't miss an episode. Subscribe over on iTunes. All right, let's turn to Bob Murphy. You guys all know Robert P. Murphy by now, no doubt. Bob is the author of numerous books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. He's the author of a textbook for young people called Lessons for the Young Economist. If you Google that book, you can find it online for free, along with a teacher's edition. He also wrote study guides, very helpful study guides, to the major Austrian economic treatises, like Mises' Human Action and his Theory of Money and Credit, and Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. Bob blogs over at Consulting by RPM. RPM are his initials. ConsultingByRPM.com, and I urge you to follow him on a regular basis. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
All right, Bob, I've solicited questions for you. Before we get to those questions, though, I want you to talk to us about something you wrote about recently over on your blog at ConsultingByRPM.com. Because we've been hearing a lot about the minimum wage and it needs to be increased, and now there's this sense that you get from reading the newspaper that the momentum behind it seems just unstoppable because everybody, even the Republicans, favor it, even, you know, like this or that candidate favors it, or you hear that economists, so-called, favor it, including, in a recent letter, seven Nobel laureates favor an increase in the minimum wage, and you went and took this apart in a blog post. So I wonder if you can take us step-by-step through the arguments you made there.
Okay, sure. So, as you say, this is an area where it's sort of shocking to me because it used to be, it's, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, I would think, if you had said, hey, what are issues where economists generally agree on? I think most people would have said, okay, free trade and either price controls generally or minimum wage in particular. Even so-called liberal left-wing economists would have agreed that, yeah, raising the minimum wage is going to increase unemployment. I would have thought that would have been the consensus, but now things have shifted, so it's no longer the case that you have to just be a completely emotional person who's ignorant of economic theory to plausibly say raising the minimum wage helps poor, unskilled workers. And so what happened is there have been some studies coming out. I think this trend started in the 90s. Well, I'm sorry, let me just back up. Up until the 90s, the consensus in the empirical literature was, duh, raising the price of low-skill labor makes employers reduce the quantity demanded of it. And it also makes more workers try to work at those wages, and so that's what causes unemployment. So that's the standard thing, literally textbook, that economists across the country teach, intro students, is that a minimum wage will cause unemployment among the very group of people that you're allegedly helping with it. And so you got to keep that in mind. You can't ignore that huge downside. Since the 90s, though, there's been a new wave of literature seemingly overturning this result, to the point now where you've got guys like Paul Krugman, as you said, 75 other economists, because actually I don't think Krugman signed that letter for some reason, saying, that actually the evidence shows that there's hardly any effect, if any, of low-skilled employment among the people with low skills, from raising the minimum wage. So, hey, there's no downside. All we're basically doing is taking money from rich employers and giving it to poor people, and we're not even making it harder for them to get a job. So why wouldn't we do that? So do you want me to get into how they come up with that?
Well, I mean, I remember from your blog post, you were saying that, look, I haven't looked at these studies, but I highly doubt that they involve such a substantial increase in the minimum wage, right?
Sure. So yeah, there's a few things, right? So first of all, the studies that find this, and we'll talk in a second about, you know, so how could these studies be coming up with it? But you're right. I made a few points. And look, even let's just stipulate for the sake of argument that these new empirical studies are correct, and we've been wrong for all these years, thinking that it's going to reduce the quantity of labor that employers want. So first of all, these studies, I've looked at a few of them, they're couched in terms of a modest increase in the minimum wage. And you can see some of the more the careful economists, when they write op-eds and things, they will say, indeed, the cutting-edge literature says that a modest hike in the minimum wage will not significantly impair the growth of teen employment, or, you know, things like that. And so that's kind of a nuanced phrasing. And yet, the policy prescription they're recommending wants to raise the minimum wage from the current amount of $7.25 an hour to $10.10 by 2016. Okay, so that is a 39% increase. So none of these studies pops out the result in the regression analysis saying if you raise the minimum wage 39%, don't worry about it, that doesn't do anything. So I'm saying even if these studies were all gospel, it wouldn't follow that the Obama administration should go ahead with what they're planning on doing. Another point is these studies, again, let's say they're exactly true. What they're looking at is they're measuring the absolute growth in teen employment, or perhaps low-skilled employment, depends on some of what they're looking at. But they're not looking at the unemployment rate. They're looking at the absolute growth in the number of people that have jobs. And so I made the point in that blog post you're alluding to that, so even if that were all true, it still means that, or it's still consistent with, the unemployment rate going up. And if you say, well, how can that be? Well, because more people now might be trying to get those jobs working at Burger King and Wendy's if they're getting paid $10 an hour instead of $7.25 an hour. And so even if it's true that the employers hire the same number of Burger King workers, and so you say, hey, see, look at this, you know, same number of kids working as there would have been at $7.25 an hour, so obviously it didn't hurt anybody. But the type of they hire at $10 an hour might be different. And so maybe the managers on the front end, when they're interviewing people, knowing we're going to have to pay them $10 an hour, are pickier, and they, you know, that maybe they, so just throwing out an example, speaking in broad strokes, it's possible that now it's college kids who are home for the summer are the ones who end up getting hired. You know, rich white kids from the suburbs go and take a part-time job because they're getting paid $10 an hour, whereas if it were $7.25 an hour, maybe they wouldn't be as likely to do that, and so it would be the truly poor people who really need source of income, and now they're harder for them to get a job.
So in other words, you might be less likely as an employer to say, you know what, I'll roll the dice and take a chance on this kid who seems a little iffy but probably needs the job, and maybe if he comes to, you know, every day and he's punctual, maybe he'll learn some job skills. You know, maybe I'll roll the dice. Maybe you don't feel like rolling the dice when the minimum wage goes up that high. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. So again, what we're speculating here, this would all be perfectly, even if these studies were exactly true and you just looked and said, no, you know, Burger King had 8 kids on the shift before at 7.25, now they raised it to 10, and I count up, oh, still 8 kids on the shift, so clearly that didn't hurt poor kids.
Right.
But now it's maybe middle-class kids who are working, whereas right. it might have been poor kids before. So it's that, and that's perfectly consistent, even if these studies are true. And do you want to get into the super geeky thing about why those studies might not even be true?
I'd like to go super geeky, because, you know, here we are, a podcast, we're not on the air. You know, people, when they subscribe to the show, they knew what they were getting. They knew
That's
there's
true.
Going to be some geekiness here. So yeah, let's have the geekiness, and then we'll go to listener questions.
But we should say, if anyone's driving while listening to this, they should probably pull over.
Right.
You know, we don't want to be responsible.
So, all right, with that caveat behind us, let's go.
Okay, I'll try to boil it down, obviously. So with the caveat that I have not immersed myself for dozens of hours in these things, but I believe what is happening is, even in these new revisionist studies, saying, oh, wait a minute, you know what, this original consensus is wrong, when they do things like they will look at counties, because the problem is, you know, controlling, you know, getting a control group and then an experimental test group. And so what they'll do to try to hold other things equal is they'll say, let's look at counties that are adjacent to each other but happen to fall in different states. And since some states have a minimum wage higher than the federal level and other ones don't, that will give you some variation within the sample. And so you can run a regression on that and see that you'll have some states that, you know, raise the minimum wage, whereas the county right next to it in a different state doesn't raise the minimum wage. So that seems like, okay, that's a good thing. Just doing that, the answer still pops out. Yeah, raising the minimum wage seems to hurt the growth of teen employment. And so, see, what's the problem here? We're even looking at just adjacent states. Clearly, you'd think that's a smoking gun. And these latest studies, they'll say, oh, but wait a minute. What if it just so happens that the states that tend not to raise the minimum wage above the federal level happen to be located in areas of the country, like in the South, where there's nice weather that people are flocking to? And so maybe the reason employment grows in states that tend to not raise the minimum wage above the federal level is just because those states are in areas where the population's growing. So, of course, you're going to see growth in Burger King employment higher in those states than, you know, somewhere in Minnesota or wherever, you know, in New York State, for example. If the population's not growing as quickly and they have a higher minimum wage in the federal level, maybe we're unfairly blaming it on the minimum wage. So they correct for that. And at this point, I think I should stop with the econometric stuff, but I'm just saying that's what's going on. They're introducing dummy variables to try to, you know, say, well, what if it's a different region? So even on the naive analysis, looking at pairwise counties, it does pop out that the minimum wage seems to impact it. And so then it's just, now you got economists arguing about the econometrics, and if they put in more bells and whistles, the effect seems to almost go away in certain treatments. So I am working on it, and for people who want to follow my blog, you know, I will post more on that if you want to see. So my point is, I don't even accept the fact that using all the bells and whistles and correctly done, the effect disappears. But the point is, even as we talked about, even if the effect were true that they're saying, it still is completely plausible that they are hurting the employment opportunities for truly low-skilled workers. But I think what they're showing is not true. I mean, in the grand scheme, Tom, what I'm saying and what the textbooks used to say is that if you make low-skilled labor more expensive, employers will buy less of it. And these 75 economists are coming out and saying, no, maybe that's not true. They're saying maybe demand curves don't slope downward for low-skilled labor, even though we think they basically slope downward for everything else.
Yeah, that to me is the key thing, that if it's true that minimum wage doesn't have any negative effects, then why don't we have minimum prices for lumber, right? I mean, then the lumber industry will be made better off, and apparently there won't be any effects because nobody looks at prices when it comes to lumber.
And by the same token, too, I mean, these, again, it's not a one-to-one correspondence, but plenty of these economists, I'm quite suspicious, also favor a carbon tax to make Americans drive less. But, well, how do we know they're going to drive? You know, maybe all these other things that they think happen with the employers and the minimum wage, you know, why would you think making carbon more expensive would make Americans use less carbon?
You know, at some point I want to have you on to talk about climate change and stuff, because, I mean, that's just inevitable. Like, you knew once I started a show, inevitably I was going to ask you that. So at some point I want to have you on, because when you said carbon tax, that made me think of it. So we'll do that at some point. I definitely want to do that. But I want to ask you now about a few questions that people have submitted. They submitted like almost 200 questions. So I have a funny feeling
we have 199 more to get through.
I know. And the first one was from me. It wasn't even from any of them. So, in other words, I'm going to save some of these for the future. All right. But I picked out a few that either are interesting or, you know, I feel like the person, you know, is trying to figure something out. I want to help them out. So the first one, though, is a very common one. People want to know about how could the market deal with so-called negative externalities. So can you explain, first of all, to everybody very quickly, what's a negative externality? And then why is it that after explaining what a negative externality is, almost any economist other than an Austrian one immediately goes to, now here's how we devise government policy to cope with it?
Okay, sure. So the term externality in this context means it's something that is not captured in this normal market transaction. And so an externality could be positive or negative. And so it's something that two parties are doing in the market through a commercial transaction, And if it hurts other people, that's a negative externality. If it helps other people, that's a positive externality. So standard textbook examples, if I plant, you know, I buy tulips and plant them in my front garden and my neighbors like that, then that's a positive externality. And because, you know, I'm paying for the tulips and I'm getting benefit from it, but I'm not taking into account how much my neighbors like it. And so actually I'm not planting enough tulips in terms of economic efficiency. A negative externality, obvious one, is like a factory that's dumping chemicals into the river that's messing with people's drinking water or they can't go swimming. And so the company, when it figures out how many television sets to produce, it's looking at the money it's getting from its customers and how much it has to pay its workers and its utility bills, but it's not taking into account the fact that, oh, if we produce more television sets, that messes up the drinking water for people downstream. And so they're producing too many television sets compared to what the efficient number would be, because they're ignoring certain costs that are borne by others because of their activity. And so the original standard response for mainstream economists was established by Pigou, the economist Pigou, and so it's called a Pigouvian either tax or subsidy. So if it's a negative externality, he said the government should come in and levy a tax to make the offending party what's called internalize the externality. So it's a factory that's dumping chemicals in the river. Doesn't mean it should be shut down, because maybe those TVs should be produced. It's producing too many TVs above the optimal amount. And so if the government comes and imposes a $1 per television set tax, now the incentives are aligned correctly and they produce the optimal amount of TVs. They're still dumping chemicals in the river, but they're dumping fewer. And it just so happens that the gains to consumers from getting more TVs it's the point where the marginal costs and benefits work out, and that's what you want to do. So that's a standard Pigouvian framework. So the reason a lot of economists talk about that is because they don't want to appear as ideologues. They want to say, yes, the market in general is great for allocating resources, but it only works if the incentives are aligned correctly. And that's where the invisible hand flourishes and does its magic. If the price they're getting from customers is not fully reflect benefits, or if the expenses they have to pay to workers and for inputs do not fully reflect how they're draining society, as it were, from their operations, then they're not going to produce the right amount. And so that's what you need, the Pigouvian tax to come in. So the Austrian response, I mean, I think Murray Rothbard wrote the definitive one on it, just to give a few responses. The one thing is, I mean, that's a Pandora's box. You could sit there and come up with a list of all kinds of positive and negative externalities for any activity. There's no such thing as a truly private, internalized market transaction. I mean, Rothbard said that, you know, things as silly as if I wear smelly socks to work, well, I'm imposing harms on all my coworkers, and so should the government tax me for doing that? Or, you know, this is my example, like, if somebody's really funny at work and he cracks jokes all the time and people just enjoy working with him, well, technically, should he be getting subsidized for the government every time he tells a joke? You know, he's producing a suboptimal amount of jokes. So, I mean, everything you do has spillover effects on others. And so the problem is, in reality, if you give politicians that power, either tax or subsidize, they can come up with a case and just start counting all the good things or the bad things and then say, see, that's why we need to either tax this or subsidize it. It's not like it's some scientific answer. You could always come up with more on one side or the other, depending on what you wanted beforehand.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, let me inject here, because a lot of times you'll hear there's a positive externality associated with having an educated public, right? That you and I benefit if our fellow citizens are literate and they're more productive, and we benefit from that, even though I don't contribute to their tuition payments and so on. So education then will be underproduced on the market because we get the benefits, we can free ride off them without contributing. So we should all be forced to contribute, and that's why we have tax-funded education. But you could just as easily say that all the wonderful personality traits that you and I have acquired laboriously over the years also benefit society. And yet, I wasn't subsidized in that. You know, when I took those etiquette courses, you know, I took that on my own dime. Why aren't we subsidizing etiquette courses? I mean, you're right. There's no logical stopping point. The problem, though, is people then will use this and say the Austrian response, if there really is one, because strictly speaking, Austrian economics is purely descriptive, but as human beings, Austrian economists tend to have opinions on a lot of issues, and their opinions on how to deal with, for example, pollution are going to seem unrealistic to people. Like, really, you really think that a legal response, given that the government monopolizes the legal system and every case takes 5 years and my kids will all be dead from poisoned water by then, is the best way to handle it? I mean, what do you how do you deal as a theorist of the stateless society, Bob Murphy, how do you deal with this tricky issue of just a standard case of a smokestack emitting pollution?
Okay, that's great points you raised there. So, just for people who don't know, it was not the case that historically factories could do whatever they wanted, dump chemicals in the river and so on, and it was just people were sitting there dropping on over dead. And then thank goodness, finally, because Pigou published this paper and then all these regulators and tax authorities got together and said, holy cow, we can help. What can we do to save poor kids from drinking dirty water? And then they started levying taxes, and finally the corporations were brought to heel. That's not what happened historically. Historically, what happened is under the common law, if you were downstream from the factory, you could bring an injunction against them and say, look, they're violating my property rights, that I'm supposed to be able to get the drinking water that was, you know, historically a clearly something I would have been entitled to when I bought this property, and clearly the factory is aggressing against me. I don't know what the legal terminology would be, just as if somebody, they came onto your property and just started ripping boards off your house and saying, well, we need to burn this in order to make the TVs, they would be stealing from you and you would have a legal case against them. They can't do that. And as Rothbard explains, because of the drive for industrial revolution and these local governments thought that they needed to promote industrialization and that they didn't want to discourage these factories, that, oh, that's too inefficient. If some factory can be stopped in its tracks because some homeowner downstream brings a court case against them, that seems crazy. And so it was government action that threw out the precedent from the common law tradition. And so it's only, as so often happens, to say the government needs to come in and tax to make them internalize the externality, it's at best the government just correcting the previous government mistake when they guessed wrong the other way and thought they should do the other thing. More generally, look, people aren't stupid. I mean, it's not like there's a bunch of people in the marketplace just sitting around looking at the factory dumping chemicals and saying, well, I guess that's just life. And that's, it's not as if only interventionists are the only people who can perceive problems and try to come up with solutions. There's all kinds of things that would happen in response to that, like developers who are buying land and going to build a subdivision of homes and then try to sell them to homeowners. They would, in order to sell property, one of the perks would be, oh, by the way, we're going to be able to guarantee you that if you come in here, you have the legal ability to not have a bunch of tar dumped into your pool in the backyard, right? The way the market works, people would come up with ways to contractually make sure that they were getting what they thought they were getting. And so, yes, there would be cases of where the public might be outraged by something, but then they would quickly work to get around that. And it's certainly not a panacea to say, oh, well, let's just have the government fix it. And the last thing is, you can see that some of the most polluted areas on Earth were in the former Soviet Union, because the Soviet government thought that industrializing was more important to achieve its objectives than the health of some kids living in some podunk town that they didn't really care about, that weren't members of the party. And so this idea that because there are powerful bad people out there who don't care about the little guy, therefore let's give more power to the government, it's just an utterly absurd non sequitur. We don't have to deny that there are environmental problems to say giving more power to the government is surely not the way to solve them.
Well, I want to recommend that people read the article you mentioned, Murray Rothbard, Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution. You can Google it and read it. I want to keep you a little longer, Bob, if you don't mind. I want to ask you a couple questions that probably are going to seem easy or elementary, but I bet there are a lot of listeners who have these questions and they don't know where to get the answer, because everybody who writes on these topics assumes everybody already knows the answer. So I want to ask you, first of all, somebody asks, how does the Federal Reserve artificially adjust interest rates? And also, when the Fed creates money, where does it inject that money? I mean, you don't have to take very long on this, but what's the answer?
Okay, great. So when the Fed so-called sets interest rates, it's not the same way that the government would set the minimum wage, for example. So that when the Fed wants, it's like, let's say the federal funds rate 6% and they want to lower it to 5%, it's not that they say, we're going to throw you in jail or fine you if we catch you charging somebody above 5%. it's a market rate, and I'm putting markets in air quotation marks here on the phone with you. And the way they do it, though, is because they adjust the quantity of what's called reserves in the system. So the Fed, if it wants to push down interest rates, will buy assets and in the process inject money into the economy. And so now the banks have more reserves to be able to lend to each other. And so the interest rate they charge on those loans tends to go down because the supply increased. And if the Fed wants to raise interest rates, it will sell off assets from its books and thereby suck money out of the system. And so now the banks have fewer reserves. And so when they're making those loans to each other of reserves, they tend to charge a higher rate of interest. So that's the way it adjusts interest rates. It's by adjusting the quantity of the reserves that are the thing being lent for those rates that you see quoted. As far as when it wants to inject money in the economy, how does it do it? It happens in the process of when the Fed buys assets. And so on the one hand, it's quite simple, but on the other hand, when I explain this to a lay audience, people, just normal people who have never heard this stuff before, they think that I'm giving them a metaphor, that I'm dumbing it down somehow because they can't believe this is what happens. But it is. If the Fed wants to buy $1 billion in treasuries, it will give a check to somebody, you know, probably electronic, to the dealer who has it. And so now the Fed takes those $1 billion in treasuries onto its assets, into its books, and now that person has a check for $1 billion, deposits it at a commercial bank. The commercial bank says to the Fed, hey, we've got a check here to, you know, Goldman Sachs for $1 billion drawn on you. Is this legitimate? The Fed says, yes, it is. And they say, okay, we're going to credit Goldman Sachs' account with $1 billion, and now the commercial bank says to the Fed, and our account with you will now have $1 billion more in it, because we're giving you this check. And the Fed says, that's exactly right, and they change it on the computers, and boom, that's what happens. So the money directly comes in the act of buying an asset. The Federal Reserve creates that money, because it's not like there's an account somewhere of the Fed's money that gets drawn down when they buy stuff. No, the Fed literally just creates that money in the act of buying an asset, and then ultimately when that check gets deposited somewhere, that commercial bank then sees its account with the Fed get credited with that amount.
All right, I've got a question here from somebody who wants to know how interest rates are interrelated. He says, this is several questions, so try and balance them in your head. He says, how do interest rates on government debt affect interest rates on our savings accounts? How are they related? Why are credit card and mortgage rates different? If government rates are below 0%, why aren't other rates for borrowing that low?
Okay, so the last one's the easiest one to answer. Whether you think it's right or wrong, of course, morally, clearly the federal government is in a much stronger position to be able to repay its debts than a company, or let alone an individual. And so treasuries are much safer in terms of default risk than other types of bonds, simply because the government can tax people and it ultimately has the Federal Reserve at its disposal. And so people who are lending money are much more confident that if the federal government says we're going to give you $1,000 next year, that they'll be able to do that, compared to GE, or let alone compared to 22-year-old who has a credit card and wants to buy something worth $1,000 and charge it. So that's why you will see a spread in that riskier bonds and IOUs will have a higher interest rate. They tend to move together. That if somebody, well, let me put it this way, obviously if the federal government is willing to pay 10% on 1 year loan, you know, the federal government's willing to borrow from you at 10%, nobody would lend to somebody riskier than the federal government for less than that. So that's kind of the way it works. So as the equilibrium gets established in one market, that kind of ripples out into the other ones. And of course there's arbitrage opportunities that you can't have something that's pretty safe yielding 5% over here and something that's only a little bit riskier yielding 20% over there, that's a huge spread, and somebody would come in and exploit that. So they are all connected to each other, but they're not going to end up being exactly identical because they have different characteristics. Some of them pay off earlier than others, and different risks involved.
All right, there's more to talk about, but I think we really are at the end. Next time we're going to talk about the the question people keep asking about, is it possible to avoid a dollar collapse? And it's so interesting to raise that question when so many people today would say, what are you crazy? Of all things to be concerned about, when we should be worried about, if anything, maybe disinflation or even deflation. We should be concerned about sluggishness in the economy, but of all things to be worried about, the collapse of the dollar. So I want to look at next time, why is that a reason for concern, and is there anything that can be done about it? But Bob, you've already been very generous with your time. You've given us good, detailed answers to these questions. So next time, just what, 196, 197 more questions to go, and we should be square.
Well, great. Thanks for having me, Tom. I love the show. And if the dollar collapses before I come back, then we don't have to answer that one.
That's a good point. That'll be the one silver lining to that whole thing. All right. Thanks again, Bob.
Thanks.
All right. That's Bob Murphy, everybody. ConsultingByRPM.com is the website there. Walter Williams tomorrow taking your questions. I've been soliciting questions over on Facebook, facebook.com/Thomas E. Woods, as well as on Twitter, where I am at Thomas E. Woods. And finally, remember my upcoming events in Maryland, Pennsylvania, Idaho, and Arkansas. Details on those on my personal site, tomwoods.com, on the events page, tomwoods.com/events. And remember, you guys are helping us pay our bills at no cost to yourselves every time you enter Amazon through our little Amazon widget at tomwoodsradio.com or at tomwoods.com. All right, Walter Williams tomorrow, everybody. See you then.
The Tom Woods Show.